Drug warlords from Colombia and Jamaica intimidate governments and their own hierarchies with violence. In major American cities, violent crime and murder rates are soaring due to the rapidly increasing use of cocaine and crack. Drug-related crimes are even moving into smaller cities. And in the neighborhoods, teenage kids serve as the foot soldiers in these drug operations. Lured by the huge sums of money to be made and young enough to be immune from the threat of jail, they're on the streets, selling drugs, running crack houses, working as bodyguards and lookouts, doing drugs, and getting killed. For almost 5 years, my guest, sociologist Terry Williams, observed a group of teenage cocaine dealers in New York's Spanish Harlem. He's detailed how they go about their business in his new book, The Cocaine Kids. Williams follows the lives of Max, who started the business, Hector, Max's brother, Kitty, the only woman in the group, and her husband, Splib, who at 19 was the oldest member, also Charlie, Jake, and Master Rap, and Chili, the boy who by the end of the book is dead. Terry Williams is a senior research scholar at the Center for Social Research at the City University of New York. In 1985, he co-wrote Growing Up Poor, and he's now working on a study of the culture of public housing projects. I asked Williams if he felt in danger hanging out in cocaine houses and bars.
Not particularly. I've been doing this type of research for quite some time. And usually what happens over many years, you develop these networks of contacts, and I've developed quite a number of them in the underground economy. One of whom introduced me to Max when he was 14, the young man in the book, who's the leader of the crew. And they always watch my back. And I consider myself pretty savvy, and I really didn't feel that I was in any danger. And I think that's kind of overplayed anyway.
What was it about you and the way that you approached these young cocaine dealers on the street, these teenagers, that let them trust you?
Well, I always run this down. Do you have a biographer?
No, I don't.
You don't? Well, neither do I. But if you think for a second, they do, and that's me. I'm there to write about their lives. I mean, that's an impressive thing to them. Who else cares? Well, here's a man who wants to write about me. And they liked that, as you would or as I would. And that provided me with a kind of entree that most people don't have. I was sincere about it. They checked me out for a very long time. But that was, you know, that was really the basis of it, just to approach them as honestly as I could, and that's what I did. And, of course, being introduced by somebody who they knew and trusted.
Well, how did they check you out?
Well, they wanted to see if I used cocaine. They wanted to know if I was an undercover. I mean, there's something that relates to something called the tail. And the tail in a con game is like where you sort of, there are sort of idiosyncratic instances where you know whether this person is giving something away or not that would indicate their vulnerability. In the drug business, it's if you don't use cocaine, you're considered to be an undercover if it's offered to you. Now, since I didn't use cocaine, how did I get around that? Well, one of the things was that I'm a writer. I'm interested in recording what's going on in their lives. And I just don't do drugs. That was convincing enough for them. Calling up the university, the numbers that I gave, to see if I was really there, that was enough for them. When I went with them to different places, the way I approached all of that, they several times they came to my house. You know, lots of times they came to my house. They could see the books. They could see my life and see that I was as honest as I had said I was. All of that, I think, added to their belief that I was cool, you know, and or chill.
My guest is sociologist Terry Williams. Could you describe a day of research amongst the cocaine kids, the kind of street scene that you found in New York City?
Well, I used to go out sometimes without prompt, meaning there were times when I would get calls from them to say, come here, go there with me, this is happening or that. But I lived in Washington Heights on 155th Street, and I would go out I would go out, and that's where I first saw Max, on the street selling drugs, even though I didn't know he was the kid I would later be introduced to. But I would go out and simply hang out, meaning there's this bar which is right up the street called El Cubano in the book, and I would go and sit there, and I would see some of the kids and see what was happening. They would talk to me and tell me, you know, what was going on, what had recently gone down, a shooting, a fight, a major deal, a bust, a family problem here or there, whatever it might be. And then that might lead to another scene. Let's go over here. There's a spot that we just found. And I would go in one of the cars and they would zip me around there. And then I might go to another scene. Then I end up going to the park, for example. This was a common thing. I only wrote about it maybe once or twice in the book. But we would often go to the park to play paddleball in Riverside Park. And then I might not see them for 3 weeks. And from there, something else might jump off. Max would call me and say, oh, I just received this package or that package. I'd like for you to see it. Or I'm instituting I just got a new number. He would change his phone number at least every 3 months. Or I just got a new address. Come and check this new crib out I have. So it was like that for several years.
I wonder if you could describe the setup of one of these cocaine houses.
You would walk in and see a table with a U-Haul scale on top. You will see stacked aluminum foil sliced into squares of about 4 or 5 inches in diameter. On the left of that, you might see a pile of cocaine, which could be anywhere from 3 to 10 or so ounces. Next to that on the floor, you would see a bag, a shopping bag. And you would usually see a young man sitting behind the scale. To his left or right, you would see another young man sitting in a chair, might have a 9mm semi-automatic, might have a Uzi. The cocaine, the kid behind the scale might have a 9mm in his waistband. You would see a guard, another person standing at the door. And you would probably see several people lined up to buy the product, which is the common practice. You might have 8 people who are allowed in. The guard closes the door, stands behind that 8th person to observe what's going on. They are facing the scale boy. They pull out money, what they want, $20, $50, $100. The scale boy puts it on the scale. They take the money, put the cocaine in the aluminum foil, pass it to the person, says next, puts the money in the shopping bag. And that's usually the way it works. The place is usually just a sofa, maybe a few chairs, a makeshift bed in another room. It's unpainted, disheveled. There's usually no food. Might see some beer in a refrigerator. That's probably much what it looks like.
What was your reaction when you first walked into one of these houses?
Well, what always strikes you is the openness of it all. Here you have a situation where you have an illegal drug, supposedly, being sold as if it's legal. Anybody can come in, of course. That you have the walkers down on the street, the touts and the lookouts, who will indicate to you, the passerby, which house you go in, because they are working for different houses. And they get what they call a PC, which is a percentage of the amount that the person they bring in buys. Also called a piece of crack or a piece of coke too. But the PC is, the walkers will take that person up to one of the houses. And then when the sale is made, they're given a small amount of cocaine and or money for bringing that person up. So that kind of action is is a bit unusual with an illegal product such as it is. Mm-hmm. And that's probably the only thing. I mean, nothing really surprises me in this. I've been looking at this business for quite a long time.
How much money would these kids make?
Well, at first, you know, they really didn't make very much money compared to the kind of money that was out there. When Max first started, the gram was about $100. Cocaine was $100 a gram. To ask them about their money, it's like asking a man about his, you know, after he wakes up the next morning, about how was sex with his wife. Even though I was very intimate with these kids in other ways, meaning they would tell me all about their sex life. I saw them perform sex, and there were all kind of things going on. And the drugs was all there, But asking them about money seemed to be a little problematic. So I approached it very gingerly with Max. And he, of course, said, "What do you mean? What do you want to know?" And I said, "Well, I have some idea about how much money you make because I see the kilo packages. I see the volume that's going down, but I really don't know how much money is here." He said, "Well, I told you that, you know, I get a kilo. The man wants $40,000 for it, $30,000 for it. I charge people $40. I make $10 on a key." So I said, "Yeah." I said, "But, you know, how can I know that that's the case?" And he said, "Well, I'll show you." So I was there a couple of times when the importer came by. I didn't really meet the importer. I happened to be there on three occasions when he came through. And this is part of the danger thing that I mentioned. And he would come in with the packages, have the packages delivered, rather, because the importer never really brought them there. He would walkie-talkie to a man outside who would follow him over. He would come in and see if the place was all right. I mean, there was nobody there that was threatening or nothing happening. He would walkie-talkie the guy in the car and his backup, and he would bring the material over. That's what the kids refer to cocaine as, material. And I wanted to know how much money was being made, so I would sit there and actually see him count money. And sometimes 4 or 5 hours counting money. And I started to record this, and I documented how many kilos he would get per week and the amount that he would get per kilo. And over the years, I documented that Max was making on the average $10,000 a week. This was when he was 16 years old, at about 16 years of age, 2 years or so after I met him. He was grossing about $10,000. That's without expenses, meaning he had to pay off the crews, he had to buy cutting and adulterant materials, scales, the U-House scales, pay for his back, meaning his protection and all of that. And, of course, he had to pay off some of that money. He had to pay off what they referred to as the get-high cops. And the get-high cops were, of course, police officers who would come in and flash their badges in the coke house and take the drugs and the money. But it operated around a $10,000 figure, and that's what he made until I left the scene.
One of the things that struck me about your book was the sort of the entrepreneurial zeal that these young teenagers brought to their business, the qualities of organization that were necessary as 15, 16-year-olds in order to handle huge amounts of money and work with employees. In many ways, it represented in a bizarre way, Puritan work ethics, 24 mm-hmm. hours a day, 7 days a week, always on hand to provide service.
Yeah. It's interesting because what these kids were doing is the very thing that works against most minorities in this country, particularly black folk and African Americans, and that is to believe so much in the American dream that you can do it by yourself. You can do it as an individual and not as a collectivity. And they are doing this as a collectivity. And that's what the crew is all about. And so when you look at ethnic groups that have sort of made it, you see this kind of collective effort come about, not the individual one. While it certainly represents a certain amount, it's honorable to try and do it individually, but it doesn't work. Not for a generation, not for a whole people. It works only for an individual. So here are these kids who have this penultimate belief in the American dream, going about it in a way that many other ethnic groups have done it too, done the same way. They've tried an illegitimate path to get to legitimacy. And if you remember the little epigram at the beginning with Master Rap, when he said we had to go all the way live at least for a minute, go legit. That's what it's all about. He said get the money illegally, but eventually we got to go into the legitimate sector, and that's what they were all trying to do.
Despite this extraordinary business that they were in, and dangerous business, were there any elements that came through that reminded you of ordinary teenagers that you had seen in your own past growing up? Or was it just so much street life that they were like a teenager you'd never seen before?
Well, in many ways they were, because, you know, I grew up in the country. I mean, I got up every morning and went to slop hogs and milk cows and do that sort of thing. So this was vastly removed from my early childhood. I think the things that touch on just being kids that came about was the emotional side of things. Kitty, for example, feeling tremendous pain around Splib's dalliances. The petty jealousies that went on between them, some of the rivalry that went on between Chili and Max over very small things. You talk about the products, just the mere accumulation of so many, you know, of these toys. I felt was a very childish thing. Well, we all do it, but it, you know, to duplicate everything, they had to have two of everything, for example. But I think most of the time when they were kids was when they felt most vulnerable, when they needed adults, because they didn't really need adults very much. They only needed adults when they were in trouble, because for the most part they did everything for themselves. And so it was usually around something emotional, some trauma that one of them had, that you could see that they were kids or acted as kids. But you didn't really see much of a childhood. I didn't see much of a childhood with any of these kids.
Were you able to keep your emotional distance as an observer, or did you find yourself being really upset by what was going on?
You know, you can't keep an emotional distance, and I don't pretend to. I'm not a person who, quote, sociologist who, you know, sits back and says, well, I have to be objective here and write this just as, you know, from afar. Of course, I was moved, you know, to talk to Kitty and her with her problems, to Max and his, and anything that came up like that, I would express my feelings. But one of the things I didn't do was to come down heavy on these kids about what they should or should not do related to the drugs. For example, it was only at a real late point that I had a chat with Hector after Hector had stolen some drugs from Max. Actually, he had gone to friends and told friends that Max had okayed his borrowing cocaine from them, and Max would repay them, which was a lie. And I knew it was a lie, and I happened to be in the apartment with him when he was telling this guy this, and he was trying to hide it in Spanish. And so after we left, I said, "Look, you know, why are you doing this? You shouldn't do that." But I knew, because he was basing, and he said, "Look, I'm having real trouble. I can't stop." And it just made me cry almost, because I could see that he was having tremendous problems, and he was doing things totally irrational, and, you know, but couldn't do anything about it. And I called up some places to some people to see if he could get into rehab places. They were extraordinarily expensive at that time, and nobody had anything to very much to do with cocaine addiction. And there was some place I called, I think, in Minnesota about him to get him in. And I talked to Max about it. Max said he wasn't going to pay. I don't know, it was like $1,000 or something a month. It was something. Even though he was making all that money, he said Hector needed to go back to Santo Domingo. And that's where he went.
Have you heard from the DEA as a result of this book? Has anyone inquired about you?
No, but the NIDA has. I gave a talk in Texas, the National Institute of Drug Abuse, but not the DEA, no.
No. Yeah. What has been the fate of these kids? You last saw them, what, 3 years ago? Are they still in the business?
Jake is the only one that I know of that's in the business.
And the rest have what, gone on to...
Well, of course, you know, Chili died in Santo Domingo, and Hector went back to Santo Domingo, and now he's back in New York, where he was the last time I heard, which was like in 88. Kitty got married. She had a kid with Carlos. I met him, and I've seen the new baby. And Charlie, last time I talked to Charlie was he was going to community college, which I can't mention which one, but he was going to community college here in New York, and I wished him well, and he wanted me to write him a letter of recommendation.
Have they seen the biography? Have they seen the book?
No, they haven't seen the book, but you know, I'm having a book party, and I've invited, I'm going, trying to find as many of them as I can to invite them.
Well, Terry Williams, I'd like to thank you very much for coming in and telling us your story here on Fresh Air today.
Okay, thank you very much.